Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How would you plan your life if you knew you would live 100 years? What about 120 or 150? Even with the sophisticated healthcare available in the developed world, living a full century is still quite unusual. But the number of centenarians among us is rising, and some scientists now imagine a typical human lifespan in the future might be nearly double what it is in the U.S. today. So how will all those extra years change the nature of human existence? Sonia Arison is associate founder, academic advisor, and trustee at Singularity University. She explores these questions in her new book, 100 Plus, How the Coming Age of Longevity Will Change Everything, from Careers and Relationships to Family and Faith. It's out now in a paperback edition. Sonia, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
It seems surprising that you would have to convince people to look forward to greatly extended lifespans. But if you look at like the literature of the past, when we imagine this, it's all sad vampires and mad scientists and Dorian Gray.
Exactly, yes. And I think that's because, you know, for the longest time, there was never any real chance of doing any radical extension of our health spans, not just our lifespans, but our health spans. And that's an important distinction because, you know, when you talk to people about, oh, well, you know, humans might have an average life expectancy of 120 or 150, some people sit back and go, whoa, that doesn't sound good. You know, I don't want to be really old and decrepit for a long period of time. And that's not at all what the goal is, of course. The goal is to extend health so that people are healthier for longer periods of time and not sick or feeling old.
What arguments, philosophical arguments, have there been against developing habits and technologies that would let us live to be healthy beyond what we've known to be possible?
Oh, there's all sorts of arguments. I think probably the most common sort of knee-jerk one that resonates with a lot of people is, well, it's really not natural. You know, it's a little bit weird to use technology to radically extend our health spans. And, you know, at first you kind of think, well, yeah, maybe it is a bit weird. But when you look back in time, you sort of say, well, what is natural? Because, you know, in the Cro-Magnon era, people only lived to an average of 18 years. Is that what the natural human lifespan is?
Hmm.
Well, yeah, now we're really unnatural if we're living to an average of 80 these days. During the European Renaissance, it was 30 years average life expectancy. In 1850, it was only 43 years. Look how far we've come from 1850 to now. 43 to around 80 years. I mean, that's roughly a doubling.
Hmm.
So, you know, I think the natural argument does not really make a lot of sense because there is no sort of set, oh, humans are supposed to live for this period of time and that's it.
And what accounts for the larger number of centenarians that we already have among us today?
Well, there's two ways to look at it and two reasons for why life expectancy has risen so dramatically. First of all, there were innovations that saved human beings at the beginning of life,
mm-hmm.
like better nutrition, really easy sort of low-hanging fruit, better sanitation. You know, we manage waste a lot better, antibiotics. All those things save people at the beginning of life, and that served to propel life expectancy quite a bit. But then, so some people look at that and go, oh, you know, that's great, and we've done all of that, but how much further can we really go? Well, if you look at the research, it turns out that in the second half of the 20th century, improvements after age 65 are due to things that we're saving people at the end of life. We're fighting cancer. We're fighting heart disease. We're actually making a good deal of progress on fighting those diseases. And that's where the extension is coming from now, and that's where it will come from in the future.
Yeah, I love those statistics that say that if you make it to 65, you're quite likely to be around at 85.
Right. Yes, exactly. And if you make it past 90, then you're really doing great.
So currently, we're worried about countries whose elderly populations come close to exceeding their young adult populations. You think, though, that in the future, the wealthiest countries will also be those that have the most very old but healthy people?
Exactly. Yes. The world will look like the world will look much different in the future when humans can live longer, healthier. So you can have a 100-year-old who's still at work, still in the workplace, doing things and being productive. And then, you know, then the news articles won't be about this scary gray tsunami from the point of view that, oh, there's all these people we have to take care of. It'll probably be more like news headlines like, wow, how are we going to get the older and younger generations to work together better? Because there really is kind of an attitude divide or a cultural divide between these groups of people.
Yeah, I've thought about that. A few weeks ago, we had an attorney on who was talking about a problem for young lawyers trying to get jobs is that older lawyers aren't moving out of senior positions, and so there's no room for younger people to move up. I wonder how that would be if it's not an issue of retiring at 70, but an issue of retiring at 120. Would there be room for young people to enter the workforce and make progress?
Right, and I think that will be one of the challenges in the future. But, you know, I think that's actually a good challenge to have. I mean, oh, we still have healthy people around who are driving the economy. I mean, I'd much rather have that than the illnesses and the diseases that we can't battle. But, I think it will be a different world. I mean, maybe seniority will cease to become quite so important, and employers will look at different things when they're hiring people. And I mean, I think a lot of things have to change in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we need to look at, right now there's the sense that people get to a certain age and they're no longer keeping up. But that's not a given as people get older.
No, it's not a given. And, I live in Silicon Valley, where the culture here and seems to be that, it's always young people who start interesting companies.
Right.
And so when I started out writing this book, I thought, wow, that's interesting. You know, I wonder if that's real, if it's true. And I started digging into some of the innovation data and who starts companies and all of that kind of stuff. And it turns out that innovation is actually a late peak field.
Hmm.
Innovation, according to scholars who study this, peaks at age 40. So, and you look at that, and at least from my perspective, I say, well, okay, it peaks at 40. And that's probably because at that point, you've had enough experience. You've maybe, dabbled in one area, and then you dabbled in another area, and then you figured out that these two areas have something in common. So you've had enough time to look at different areas and draw conclusions and bring it all together, and that's when innovation really kind of peaks. And then the question is, well, why does it start to decline after 40? And maybe that's because health starts to decline at 40. So what if we could extend health span? Would the innovation peak keep going? I mean, that's a really interesting question for me.
Yeah. And I was thinking about this because there are other fields that peak much later or in which people stay really relevant much later. You think about things like architecture and literature. There are people who are working simply as long as their bodies will let them work. And if they had another 20 or 30 years, what could a Mark Twain have done for us? Or what could a Frank Lloyd Wright have done for us?
Right. Well, Benjamin Franklin was 46 when he did his famous kite experiment.
Hmm.
He was 55 when he invented the glass harmonica, and he was 78 when he invented bifocals.
Yeah.
So what if he could have lived longer, right?
Hmm. So one of the things that we're looking at, that scientists are looking at to allow us to live longer and healthier lives, is to simply replace the parts of us that wear out.
Right. So that's sort of the low-hanging fruit of regenerative medicine, if you will. The starting point of, already it's possible, which is why it's exciting. And I was very careful when I wrote my book to only talk about science that was real, that was possible, that was happening now, not something that's science fiction, not something that might happen in the future, stuff that's real.
Hmm.
And I found a lot of it. Scientists are able to grow a number of different human body parts out of a person's own stem cells. Windpipes have been grown, bladders have been grown, blood vessels have been grown. In the lab, scientists have already grown hearts, not human hearts yet, but pig hearts. And, already pig parts are used for replacement in humans. So it's not that far out before we start replacing a number of body parts and allowing people to live longer than they would have. But I don't think that's the end, of course. There's other things that can be done to allow human beings to live longer and healthier lives.
It sounds awesome and yet very expensive. Will there be like a greater chasm between the haves and the have-nots that now involves the people who live to 65 and the people who live to 150?
Right. That's a good question. It's unclear how all of this is going to play out. I mean, I think that it's absolutely true that there's going to be a bigger divide between the haves and the have-nots, at least in the very beginning. I mean, and even now, when you look at life expectancy within the U.S., around the world, there's a huge divide that most people aren't even aware of.
Yeah.
I mean, on the international scale, you know, the country with the highest life expectancy is Monaco at around 90 years. And the country with the lowest life expectancy is Angola at 38 years. That's a 50-year difference, 51-year difference.
And so that has to do with
your lifetime.
Yeah, that's public health and wealth and access to care, that sort of thing.
Right. And then within the U.S., there's a fairly big divide as well. A Native American male in South Dakota has a life expectancy of only 58 years, whereas an Asian American female in New Jersey has a life expectancy of 91 years. So that's a 33-year divide.
So we've talked on this show in the past about, you know, this idea of calorie restriction allowing us to live much longer. Should we assume that we'll have to make these sorts of pleasure sacrifices in order to have a really long life?
No, because I don't think anyone will do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very small percentage of people who are trying that now.
Right.
And it does, you know, the science does show that it works in animals. So whether or not it works in humans is, you know, still unknown, and I guess we'll see the results of the – it's a very long-term experiment, but I don't think very many people are willing to do it. So that really is not the way it's going to happen. But, you know, the reason why caloric restriction works is it tweaks certain genes that all human beings have that sort of put the body into a mode where it repairs itself better and slows down aging. And scientists are working on gene therapy to change those genes. And so potentially you can imagine in the future, and this has already been done in a lab with animals, by the way, it's possible to tweak genes to slow down aging, which means that people, or you know, at least the lucky lab animals, were able to live longer in a healthier state because the scientists were able to show that they could slow down aging.
Yeah, there's some amazing illustrations in the book, and there are some, are they monkeys, where there's a remarkable difference between the ones that were given a particular treatment and the ones that were not.
Yeah, if you look at the photos of the monkeys in my book, it's really quite amazing. The caloric restricted ones look amazing. They don't look very happy, though. And the regular ones just kind of got old and crotchety as well, but they still look a little bit happier.
Yeah, it is nice to think that if we're able to tweak our genes, that we might not just feel good for a long time, but we might actually look good for a long time.
Right. And there's a number of things happening on that front as well, which I didn't go into in the book, but I guess that could be an entirely new book.
But I wonder, you know, if we truly are in a society in the future that has people living to 150, maybe the culture of worshiping youth and only youth won't be so strong, and maybe we won't feel pressured to look 20 when we're 40.
Right. And I think the idea of what youth is might change, too.
Hmm.
I mean, is youth about energy and being healthy, or is it about having perfect skin? Right now, I think we think about how somebody looks. But that's really a signal for something else, isn't it? I mean, the way somebody looks is a signal for how much longer they're going to be energetic and do things. And, you know, and so I think that may change in the future.
My guest is Sonia Arison. She's associate founder, academic advisor, and trustee at Singularity University and author of the book 100 Plus, How the Coming Age of Longevity Will Change Everything from Careers and Relationships to Family and Faith. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sonia Arison. Her new book is called 100 Plus, How the Coming Age of Longevity Will Change Everything from Careers and Relationships to Family and Faith. Join this conversation by emailing think at kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, so when you talk about people living 150 years, maybe working 120 years, that certainly requires an education that will be a very strong foundation, if not something that we'd need to refresh and renew every half century or so.
Right, and I think that's exciting, actually. I think education, when we can live longer and healthier lives, people will get educated throughout their lives, not just this one big chunk at the beginning of their life. It'll be a lifelong learning. And, you know, the education market is changing right now as well, which will make it potentially easier. I mean, there's now online learning, and, you know, you can imagine in the future there'll also be virtual classes and those types of things. So, yes, definitely people will go back and get reeducated and have many different careers, more so than they do today.
Yeah, and not just sort of second careers that are part-time, but fully, you know, shifting gears at age 75.
Right. And you can imagine being a lawyer for, you know, part of your life, going back to school and then becoming a doctor. You really could do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Rick in Dallas. Hi, Rick.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Great, thank you.
You know, I had this thought the other night, putting my son down, and we just started thinking about robots, and I thought, wow, what if, I'm just curious if anybody is experimenting with the thought of taking somebody who agreed to give their brain at the end of their life, or if something tragic happened, like a donor program, and then somehow thinking about taking that brain and connecting it to a new body, or extending that mental life into a new body, or I mean, I know that sounds kind of strange, but, you know, I'm sure people are thinking about it.
Yeah, well, if the brain is the seat of consciousness, it makes perfect sense. What do you think, Sonia?
Oh, yes. There are certainly people thinking about that. And there's all different types of strategies that, you know, various engineers and computer scientists and people who are involved in that field are looking at. You know, there's a field called cryonics where, you know, some people think that, you know, literally today, some people have signed up for this service where when you die, they actually have to get to you before you completely die, because when you officially die, you still have a little bit of activity left, and they get there and they freeze either your entire body or just your head, with the idea that at some point in the future it might be possible to thaw you and bring you back to life, whether, you know, it's in a new body or in your own body or that kind of thing. So there are definitely people thinking about it. We're not anywhere close to doing that. One of the things I'm excited about, though, right now is there's a lot of activity focused on the brain. I mean, President Obama just was trying to get support for this brain initiative, but there's a lot going on in the private sector as well, because a lot of computer companies are interested in figuring out how the human brain works so that they can build computers that work in a similar way. And so you've got a lot of very, very smart people working on solving the problem of the brain, because the brain really is the part of the human body that scientists understand the least.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also call, you can also send email, rather, to think@kera.org. So, Sonia, when you think about 150-year lifespan, the phrase, till death do us part, I'm sure delights people more than ever and also frightens other people. Can marriages, relationships possibly last, say, 120 years?
Right. Well, I imagine that you'll probably see some people doing that. I wrote an entire chapter on family relations in my book, and, you know, what would happen, what will happen when we can extend our health spans. And the conclusion I came to is that we're going to see just a lot more diversity than we ever have before in family arrangements. You know, and probably the age at first marriage and age at first birth will continue to go up as they have in the past, as life expectancy has extended. So we'll continue to see people marrying later. But We'll also continue to see some people marrying earlier and maybe staying married or getting married, you know, 5, 10 times, something like that. So yeah, there'll be a lot of different combinations that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, and if we can find ways to extend women's fertility in particular, you think it's possible that families might produce siblings that are decades apart in age?
Yes, I think that's a real possibility. That's looking even closer and closer than, you know, some other things that are on the horizon. I mean, the reproductive science is just steaming ahead. It's unbelievable. You know, scientists now have the ability to grow a woman's eggs in the lab out of her own ovarian tissue. And once, you know, they've done it successfully in animals, they think they're going to be able to do it successfully in humans. They just, of course, have to wait for somebody to volunteer, and that might take a while. But if that's possible, you know, right now, if a woman wants to extend her fertility, she can try to freeze her eggs, but that doesn't work very well because eggs are filled, they have a lot of high water content, and you know what happens to water when it freezes, it expands, and that tends to break the cellular structure. So freezing eggs doesn't tend to work that well, and of course there's IVF, but, you know, that still only works up to a certain point, and then there's egg donors, but then it's not your own biological genetic children. So there, things are still limited today, but the science really is looking good, and in the future, it really will be possible for women to have children past 50 years. And I know that sounds scary to a lot of people, but, you know, I think in that future, we'll also be living longer and healthier, so maybe it won't seem so weird at that point.
Will childhood last longer in adolescence?
It may. That actually was one of the fun parts of my family chapter, is discovering this new, already sociologists have this term called adolescence.
Right.
So, you know, there was a time in history where adolescence didn't even exist. Like teenagers were, nobody talked about teenagers. You went straight from being a child to being an adult. And then as our lifespans extended, this new phase of life came along called adolescence, teenagers, and all of that. And so psychologists and sociologists are hypothesizing that there's this new phase of life that, in fact, that we can already see called adolescence, where, you know, kids are they're no longer teenagers, they're adults, but they're not really in adult life. They're not married, they don't have kids, they're just sort of living in cities with jobs and partying, or maybe even living at home with their parents still because they don't have a job. And that is a phase of life that sociologists expect to extend. And there may be another phase of life closer to the, you know, more to the towards the end, not where people, you know, might get to the point where they were thinking of retiring, but they're not going to retire, and they're still going to work, but do different types of things, and that may extend. And you know, some people are calling that the third age, and all of that. So definitely, there will be new phases of life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Pamela in Dallas. Hi, Pamela.
Hi there. I have a question for your guest. The question is, does she have an opinion on how far out we are on regenerative medicine as far as the human retina, whether it be stem cell replacement or gene therapy? Does she have an opinion as to how close we might be as far as that getting into the clinic?
Yes. The eye actually is one of the organs in the body that's simpler to understand and manipulate than other organs. So a lot of work is being done with eyes. Actually, if you pick up a copy of my book, you'll see I discuss eye experiments quite a lot. There's been some really great gene therapies that have helped cure people who are blind, and there's some gene therapy stem cell trials that are going on right now, and there's a lot of activity with the eye. The eye is going to be one of the areas where we see some huge, probably really successful things in the very, very near future.
Hmm. How will the possibility of, you know, 150 years change our eagerness, our willingness to enter into armed conflict?
That's a very good question. You know, I actually didn't talk about this very much in the book, but I suspect that as we can live longer, as we know we have more time, we're going to become less willing to go to war. Because if you, you know, you're 40 years old and you still have, you know, 110 years left, you're not going to want to put that at risk. So I think that the longer people can live and healthier, they know they're going to have a healthy and more productive life, which, by the way, also increases societal wealth, which tends to make societies less apt to go to war. The world should become more peaceful, but there's a but to this, because there may be some societies that don't have access to this technology. And from their point of view, I mean, you can imagine, there's one society that gets to live to 150 in a fairly healthy state. Then you have another society that only gets to live to, you know, maybe 60 years old, and they have, they're fraught with disease. I mean, what do they have to lose? They might as well attack us, right?
You initially thought that, you know, having not endless lifespans, but really extended lifespans might turn people away from religion. But can you talk about what you actually found?
Right. That was the most exciting part of this book for me personally, because I started out with this premise that as we can live longer and healthier lives, we'll probably become less religious because, you know, the afterlife really won't be that interesting anymore because we'll have so much life here on Earth. And, of course, the longer we live, the more inventions that will happen during our lifetimes. And you sort of hit this point where, you know, life will just continue to be extended and extended and extended. And maybe you just won't even care about the afterlife, and so then who cares about God? So that was sort of the premise. And I dug into the data, and I said, okay, well, if that's true, then we should probably see that looking back in time, as life spans have extended, as life expectancy has extended, people should have become less religious over time. And I dug into the data, and that's not what I found. Hmm. It's not at all what I found. And I couldn't believe it. So I triple-checked the data. I called all the scholars who were doing work in this field. And, you know, they were all telling me, no, the world is still very religious. And in some cases, it's become more religious because, of course, there were large countries like, you know, Russia and China had outlawed religion, and when those regimes fell, religion popped back. It came back. It didn't just disappear. So you had points in history where the world became less religious and then became more religious due to sort of political factors. But the thing that they emphasized to me is that the world has always stayed relatively religious, and there's some small exceptions like Western Europe that have become less religious over time. But those are the exceptions, not the rule. And their explanation to me was that, well, you know, maybe it's because religion, I mean, there's a number of different explanations, but this is the one that resonated the most with me. And maybe it's because religion is about, not just about the afterlife. It's also about the purpose of life. What is the best way to live your life? It's about guidance. And if you look at it from that perspective, then religion is incredibly relevant, and it, in fact, may become even more relevant as we live longer, because the more life you have, the more guidance you're going to need in terms of how to live your life and how to live the good life.
Should longer lifespans be a concern for people who worry about overpopulation of the planet?
Maybe. You know, that was one of the biggest concerns I had starting out. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, if people don't die at the same rate, then maybe the population will just explode and then we'll be in big trouble. So I dove into that, and I have an entire chapter on population and the environment in my book. And I found some scholars at the University of Chicago, some demographers, who actually were working on this issue. And they went even more extreme than me, because I was just looking at it, you know, if people could live to 150, how would that change population? And they said, okay, well, you know, what if it was possible to become immortal? You never die, right? And being demographers, they chose the country of Sweden because all demographers like to use Sweden. They have great numbers and good statistics and all of that, easy access to it. So they said, okay, well, what if the entire country of Sweden were to become immortal tomorrow? What would happen to population over the next 100 years? And so they took all of that data, plugged it into the same models that the World Bank and the UN use, and the number they came up with surprised me. They said, you know, like Sweden's population would only increase by 22% over 100 years. Now, 22% is not nothing. I mean, that's significant growth, but it's not nearly as big as I thought it would be. So they explained it to me this way. They said, look, you know, population growth is really driven by more births, not fewer deaths. Because births are exponential. When you have more children, you have one, two, three, four, and it's exponential. Versus when one person doesn't die, it's only one person. And so you don't have the same type of exponential population growth that you would have on the birth front. And so that explained it to me. Now, you can say, okay, well, that's fine, but what if fertility, what if a woman can increase her fertility past age 50?
Yeah.
What if she can still have children at age 60 and age 70, and she's living to 150? Well, then maybe the birth rate will pop up, right? So population growth really depends on the birth rate. Is what this all comes down to.
So there's no reason to believe that if people had a 50-year window for childbearing, that they would not, even if they had a child every 10 years, that's a lot of kids.
That's a lot of kids. So it could be a problem. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's unclear what will happen. It's really, really difficult to predict what will happen because on one hand, society will become wealthier.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that when societies become wealthier, people tend to have fewer children. But we've never been in a situation before where you can radically extend your fertility. So it's really unclear what will happen.
Hmm. We have an email here from Julie, and maybe I'll read this to you now. You can think about it and answer after the break. Julie says, can you address the issue of being older and dealing with depression? According to MHA, older people are some of the most disenfranchised. How do we age and keep people mentally healthy and engaged with a longer life? My guest this hour, who will address that question when we come back, is Sonia Arison. She's associate founder, academic advisor, and a trustee at Singularity University. Her book is called 100 Plus, How the Coming Age of Longevity Will Change Everything from Careers and Relationships to Family and Faith. We'll be back to the conversation in a moment. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Sonia Arison is my guest. She's an academic advisor at Singularity University and author of the book 100 Plus, How the Coming Age of Longevity Will Change Everything from Careers and Relationships to Family and Faith. It's available now in a paperback edition. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org. And before the break, Sonia, we heard from Julie, who had questions about how we will manage mental health as people live longer lives.
Right, and that's a very good question. I think she mentioned depression, which a number of elderly do get depressed. And one of the reasons is that they're not healthy anymore and they can't live the same type of life that they've always been living. And so that source of depression should wither away as we're able to keep people healthier for longer periods of time. Now, the second reason people might get depressed or not be mentally healthy is just brain disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that the brain is the one area, as I mentioned earlier, that is the toughest part. It's the part that scientists don't understand as well as all the other parts of the body. So it's incredibly important, actually, that as a society we focus on that, not only because we have a large number of older people, but because everybody will get old at some point, and it's just incredibly important that we figure out how to fix brain diseases.
What kind of investment does all this research require? Will most of it happen under the auspices of government labs? Will it happen in the private sector by people who are hoping to make money from extending lifespans?
It's going to happen from both directions. A lot of the regenerative medicine that I detail in my book that's already here in terms of, you know, like rebuilding organs and gene therapies and all that type of stuff. Some of it was government-funded scholarly research, but a large amount of it was funded through military grants. The Army wants to be able to fix its soldiers when they come back from war, missing an arm or a leg or a muscle or what have you. And so they're spending an enormous amount of money to repair, to figure out how to regenerate human bodies. And a lot of the discoveries have come from that type of work. So, you know, hopefully, I mean, I see DARPA spending money on understanding the brain and creating, you know, computers that can think like humans. And so we'll probably see similar things coming from that. But, you know, it's also going to happen from the private sector as well. And, you know, there's foundations like Paul Allen's Brain Foundation in Seattle. He's co-founder of Microsoft. He's working on understanding the brain and that kind of thing. So it's going to come from a team effort from all parts of society.
Money is another fascinating thing to consider here. There's the idea that people might have decades longer to be productive in the workforce and save more money. There's the idea that at some point you've sort of accumulated all the major possessions you need to buy, and therefore even if you're working hard, you're not participating in the economy in quite the same way. Can you talk about what you learned about the economic realities of much longer lives?
Well, it's clear that the longer and healthier people can live, societies just become wealthier. It's unbelievable. Even when there's only a 5-year life expectancy advantage, there was a study that was done that compared two countries relatively similar, but one had a 5-year longevity advantage. And that was huge. So, you know, even small advantages can really rock the economy. So it's but I guess maybe you were asking more of a personal question, like if people can live a long time and they have a lot of money and they're sort of comfortable, then what?
Well, I just mean, you know, there are implications for how long we save. And let me go back for a second to what you were saying about the countries with a 5-year gain in lifespan. Does money buy longevity, or does longevity pump money into the economy?
Right. That's a good question. And it goes both ways, actually. People always used to think, for the longest time, when you look back in the literature and you sort of read the historical stuff, the thought was always that wealth created health. Like, if you were rich, then it was clear you were probably going to be healthy. But it turns out that researchers also discovered that health creates wealth. And to me, that's really a no-brainer. I mean, if you're not healthy, you can't work. I mean, health does create wealth. And it's a big driver of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi. I was wondering how the increase in the population for people living longer is going to compete with the advances in automation that we're currently seeing.
That's a good question, right? What happens to the workforce when if we look at the future, and you know, other people have written books about this, about what happens when robots start to take over a lot of the jobs that humans are currently doing, what do humans get to do in that future? And, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to all play out. I mean, some people look at that and say, well, that just means there'll be more leisure time for human beings. And, you know, also, if you look back in the historical literature, there have been all of these people predicting, the work week is going to shrink from 40 hours to 30 hours or 20 hours at some point. And that's never happened. It just hasn't happened. So I'm actually kind of looking forward to the day when we can automate some things and my work week can shrink so I can do some other things. But, it's hard to say.
Yeah, it is interesting. The idea that we might have more leisure time is appealing to go along with all those extra decades we put into work. You know, some people live for the work week and some people live for the weekend.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. What would retirement look like in a scenario where most people imagine they will live around 150 years?
I don't think retirement will be defined the way it is today. I mean, today we look at retirement as it's this period of life at the end of your life where you kind of go out to pasture to rest. And, you know, I think in the future, retirement will come to mean something completely different. It'll come to mean, you know, taking off a large chunk of time to go get reeducated so that you can start that new job. Or taking off a large chunk of time to raise your children, and then you go back to the workforce. Or, you know, any number of things where you might take off a large chunk of time to do something and then come back.
When you talk to people about these ideas, when you go to speak somewhere, what are they most intrigued by? Which aspect of this appeals to them most?
That's a good question.
Or frightens them most, maybe.
You know, it's funny. I actually thought that there would be more people who might be frightened by the prospect of living a longer period of time. And I've been pleasantly surprised that very few people have.
Hmm.
And I think that comes down to, you know, I mean, human beings want to survive and they want to be healthy.
Yeah.
And this really is an issue of health. And so I think people are excited about having more time to do things, to explore and to spend time with their families and, you know, time that they wouldn't have otherwise. Time is really valuable.
Yeah.
And we will probably have more of it in the future.
It's cool to think about 50 years to be an awesome grandmother.
Right. Yes. But, and then there might be a great grandmother too and a great great grandmother. So family relations could be kind of complicated.
You'll be competing for attention and spoiling properties.
Right.
Okay. So I'm 42. I mean, is it way too late for me to hope that any of this will benefit me?
No, I don't think it is. And, you know, this, you have actually just brought up the reason why I wrote this book, because I'm 40.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I see all of this technology, and it works in the lab, but it's not widespread yet. And the question is how long is it going to be widespread before, you know, somebody who needs a new windpipe can just go, oh, I got to go in for my windpipe surgery. They're going to grow me a new windpipe. I'm going to get that next week. I mean, I want that to happen. I want to be able, you know, by the time I need a new heart, I just want to be able to have my doctor grow me one,
yeah,
and put it in, and, you know, and then I continue on with my life instead of the current situation of today where, you know, if you have heart disease, you're going to be going downhill. I mean, there is no fix for it. There's no repair for it right now. And that's not a good situation. And so, you know, I think we're at this point in history where we actually have a real chance. This is not fake. It's not science fiction. This is reality. This is a real chance to allow individuals to overcome some of these big obstacles like heart disease and cancer and big killers. And we really need to pay attention and work on it. And I don't think that we're paying enough attention to it. I mean, like I said, a lot of the research, a lot of the money that's driving a lot of this research is coming from the military. But it should be coming from everywhere. I mean, we should really, government should be spending more on this. Individuals should be donating to this. The private sector should be focusing on this more. I mean, this really should be a big push because nothing really matters more. I mean, if you don't have your life, you have nothing. So it's incredibly, and I don't want to be part of the last generation to only live to 80 years, right? I mean, I'm fairly certain that my son is going to be in the generation that gets to live to 150 years, but I'm on the cusp, and maybe you're on the cusp, and I don't want to be on the cusp. I want to be in the first generation that gets to be healthier for a longer period of time.
Yes, let's raise a toast to you and I being in the pioneers of people, you know, born in the 70s and living into the 2070s.
Exactly.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372. We have Kristen on the line in Dallas. Hi, Kristen.
Hi. I'm curious. You're talking about how a healthier society will generally becomes a wealthier society as a whole. But there certainly are people that end up, for whatever reason, on the lower end of this socioeconomic ladder. And I'm curious if what your thoughts are on what the effect of a longer lifespan on the lower end of the economic ladder would be. Certainly, people that are on the wealthier end, having a longer lifespan allows them to continue to be wealthier, I would assume. But what happens with the people that are on the lower end? And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Thanks for your call.
Right. I think that's a complicated question because we don't know why each individual person is on a lower end, right? I mean, maybe they didn't get a chance to get an education. So if that's the case, then a longer life is really quite a benefit for them because at some point, you know, they have more time to save money to go back to school. They have more time to find an opportunity to go to school. They have more time to do all of those things that they might not otherwise have done. So I think more time just benefits everyone. I can't even imagine how it wouldn't. It's a good for everyone, no matter what you know what part of the ladder you're on.
Let me ask you this, Sonia. Historically, we think about younger people sort of looking to the future and finding new ways of doing things, and we think about older people very often as being oriented toward the past. And I realize I'm making a gross generalization there, but you know, people who are in their 80s and 90s very often will say, well, it was better when, you know, in the 1950s when we did things this way. Would that be an issue potentially for us? Would society stagnate if it was sort of front-loaded with people who are really looking to older ways of doing things?
Right. That is an excellent question. And I actually spent a good deal of time trying to track down studies, psychological and sociological studies, on what happens to people's attitudes as they get older. Is it really true? I mean, because we have this generalization that, oh, older people kind of get crotchety and stuck in their ways, and, you know, then the more old people, then society won't change and all of that. And I looked and looked, and what I found actually sort of surprised me. And it turns out, at least from the literature, the psychological literature, that there's a consensus that it's actually not based on age, somebody's attitudes that way, whether or not they're flexible or very rigid. It turns out it's more of a personality trait. So, you know, everybody knows sort of younger people who are also kind of really difficult and not willing to try new things and, right, and not wanting to change, and older people who are willing to, you know, learn how to use the internet and do this and do that. And so from what I found, it was more of a personality trait than an aging trait, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Because it means that, I mean, of course, there's certain things that, you know, you can say, well, you know, what would have happened, you know, what if there were a lot of older people who sort of grew up in a time of segregation or something, and that was just what they were used to, and human beings in general just don't like change, maybe, and so it would have been really difficult to change things if we hadn't had a new younger generation coming up and creating a movement, the civil rights movement in the 60s. And I think there's something to that, for sure. Because in general, it's sometimes easy for human beings to kind of get stuck in what they know.
Got it. I'm so sorry we have to jump in here. Sonia Arison's new book is called 100 Plus, How the Coming Age of Longevity Will Change Everything from Careers and Relationships to Family and Faith. Sonia, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Today, by the way, the phones were done by Joe Bellotti. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.